Welcome to another 8-Point Roll episode of Aviator Cast in celebration of National Aviation Day. So on this episode, we talk to the director, producer, writer, editor of Living in the Age of Airplanes. His name is Brian Terwilliger. He is a very, very, very talented filmmaker who will invoke a lot of emotion in pretty much anyone that watches his films, and especially if you are passionate about aviation, you'll really enjoy his work because the last few films that he's done have been aviation-focused. So the first film that he did was 1/6 Right, which is an absolutely amazing, amazing film. Maybe a little more pilot-centric for you pilots out there, which there are a lot of you listening. And then this new film, Living in the Age of Airplanes, which was eventually picked up by National Geographic, is more in overreaching how aviation has affected humanity. And it's a big picture view, not necessarily for pilots, not a lot of, you know, nerdery about the actual flying, but more how it's really affected humanity. And it's such a cool, cool representation of that, and ends up just becoming this powerful emotional moment at the end of the movie. Now, there are some spoilers here. If you haven't seen the movie yet, it's already out. It is, it's in a lot of theaters nationwide, and it's gaining more traction. So make sure that you check it out, Living in the Age of Airplanes. You can find the URL at Airplanes Movie, I believe. Let me just verify that quickly here. And yes, that is it. Airplanesmovie.com. Really such a good film, guys. It was great to see it in person. And then after the fact, Brian was nice enough to sit down with me for a 20-minute interview, kind of a condensed interview where we learned more about what it was like to make this film, the ideas behind it, and also him as an aviator. You know, we talked to a lot of aviators on Aviator Cast, and so we get to know about his passion for aviation a little bit. Very, very cool. I hope you guys enjoy it. It's an inspiring film, so make sure that you really do go out and try to find a theater that is holding it. If you don't find a theater that is, you can request it from your local theater, and it being such a supported film, meaning that it's National Geographic, it's very likely that you could get it in a local theater, especially like some of those Science Center theaters like planetariums or IMAX screens. This is the perfect place to request that. So awesome show. I hope you guys enjoy this interview with Brian Terwilliger. If you guys want to skip this one and go see the movie first, I would recommend that because we do give away some spoilers here. So here we go. Let's get into it with Brian Terwilliger, who is the filmmaker for this new movie, Living in the Age of Airplanes, and the classic 1/6 Right. So here we go. All right, everybody, we are honored to have a very special guest with us today, Brian Terwilliger, right? That's how you pronounce your last name. That's a tongue twister. Brian, what do you do?
I'm a filmmaker, documentarian.
And what would people know you for?
Well, for pilots, they probably know 1/6 Right, which was a film, my first documentary. Came out in 2005.
Great. And what's your most recent film? We'll talk about that today, of course.
Yeah, the most recent film just came out. It's called Living in the Age of Airplanes, and it's about how the airplanes changed the world.
Great. Now, when I was flying in the lower 48, I live in Alaska now, I actually did a flight to Van Nuys after I saw that movie, and I got cleared to land 1/6 Right, and I was just so excited. It was the coolest thing. I mean, it, for a pilot, it's literally a movie that at some point will bring you to tears, and I'm sure that was part of your intention with that film, to invoke that emotion about that passion.
That was, yeah, indeed. I mean, if that, when people tell me that and they fly to one, I mean, my gosh, you know, I've heard the story. It amazes me every time that people actually are so moved to go and, you know, set foot there and land there and get cleared to land. And it came from an emotional place within me, the film itself. So when it resonates and connects with people emotionally, it's certainly extremely rewarding. And it's exactly what I would hope that it might do. And when it does, it's a wonderful thing.
Perfect. So the first big question I always ask our guests on the show is, how did you initially fall in love with aviation?
I don't know the moment that I first fell in love with aviation, but it feels like it's been forever, ever since I was a little kid. I went to air shows. My whole room was full of movie posters, aviation ones, the calendar every year, whatever it might have been. Airplanes, airplanes, airplanes. It's always been that way for me. And then I got into building model planes and flying radio-controlled model planes as a teenager. And then eventually, I always wanted to be a pilot. You know, that was sort of part and parcel of the obsession with planes and aviation as a kid. Seeing the Blue Angels fly many times growing up in the East Coast. And then my friend, my best friend, who was just as obsessed with airplanes and aviation as I was and model planes, he ended up going to take flying lessons. And he did, in fact, get his license. I think he was 18 at the time. And then he took me up. And it was incredible that here is my friend, who I've known forever, and fly model planes together, is flying. I mean, it's just, I'm looking around, it's just him and me, and we're in a plane, and we're flying. And it was incredible that, you know, you really could set out, take a lesson, take more lessons, see it through to the end, become a pilot. And so it was a reality check for, rather than saying, you know, yeah, I want to be a pilot, someday I'm going to be a pilot, rather than that future tense. It's, you know, no, I'm getting my pilot's license now, and then eventually you see it through, and then you become a pilot. And so there was that, a light bulb went off for me, that I got to stop talking about it, I'm going to go out and do it. And I did. So within 3 months of that flight, within a week or two of the flight, I had my first lesson. 3 months later, I soloed, and then I got my license another 6 months later. So
and how old were you again at that time?
I was 19.
Okay, cool. So at what time did you start film school in that mix?
So I actually didn't go to film school.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I got a business degree, but I was doing film the whole time.
Sure.
So I decided, because I wanted to produce and direct, but in order to do that, there's a lot of things that's not just the technical side or the creative side, but there's the business side. And I think inherently, I'm a creative person. I've always liked to build things, design things, technical aspects of cameras and some of the other things that are involved in making movies aren't necessarily things you have to go to school for, the things you learn on the job, or they're technical, and if you're technically inclined. So I felt the focus for me wanted to be business, and that's where I wanted to focus from an educational or collegiate level education. But as far as the film part of things, I was doing freelance work at the end of high school and through all 4 years of college.
Wow.
So I was doing freelance. So by the time college ended, I had a resume. I mean, most of it was for free or for very little money.
Sure.
But I had this resume that had commercials, music videos, you know, some independent feature films in the summer, and then a lot of shows that aren't around anymore where they interview celebrities and this sort of thing. And Movie Magic was the name of a show. And
oh, gosh, Lifestyles. I love that movie.
So, yeah, I know. Wasn't that cool? Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, random stuff. But they would do interviews with celebrities, and so we're going to different studio lots in Hollywood and setting up the interviews. So I would do lighting. I would, you know, it'd help. I'm always that third, they call him the third man.
Okay.
Usually it's a sound guy and a camera guy, and they're doing these interviews that you see in Entertainment Tonight.
Okay.
We did that too. And then I was the third guy that just helps those two guys. But when you're just the third guy, you get to do a lot of cool stuff.
Sure, yeah.
Because and anything you're doing, you're helping them. And so they give you, responsibilities, which is really cool. So I got to do quite a bit, and I gained a lot of experience over those years. Also, by the time that I was done with college, I had all those years of experience as well.
Great. So how did your aviation passion continue from there? Did you continue flying? Did you have to take a break?
So let's see. So I was in college, I guess. And so, no, I just kept flying. And it was uninterrupted. It was all sort of simultaneous. I was getting my license, working in the industry, and going to college. It was important to me to finish within those 4 years. I really wanted to be done with it. You know, school was not my favorite part of all the things we're talking about today.
Right.
I was able to do it in 4 years and then get out there and start really doing what I wanted to do. But it was a very busy few years of my life, for sure.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about Living in the Age of Airplanes and this movie. And to preface this, I want to give a spoiler alert. So anyone listening to this audio, this podcast, you need to go out and see the movie, because we're about to spoil some things with some questions here. So find your local theater. Let's see, it's airplanesmovie.com. You can find your local theater. If it is not available at your local theater, you can also request that your local theater carry it. So let's talk about, because I just saw the film, great visual storytelling, and also to have someone like Harrison Ford narrating it, who is a pilot, also James Horner doing the music, who you said is also a pilot. Very cool. Let's just talk about the process and maybe some of the more unique aspects of your experience in making the film. So let's just start off with a fun question. Was there any point during the filmmaking that you were scared?
Scared. Scared for my life or scared the endeavor? I can't think of any particular moment I was scared. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, certainly maybe overwhelmed or, you know, there's stressful times, stressful moments, just in the process of a several-year project. Mm-hmm. But because there's, you know, when you make a movie, you're doing thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of little tiny things every day that add up to eventually one single experience that is no longer pieces or parts. It's a thing. It's an experience. You know, mm-hmm. it all comes together. So, you know, seeing the forest through the trees and having the ability to keep seeing the big picture, you know, is always or is often a challenge, especially as you get later and later in the process, in the editorial process, and the filming's finished, and some of those big exciting things or the things that show more progress on a day-to-day basis mm-hmm. when you're filming. Okay, we got those shots. Okay, we actually got that location. Mm-hmm. Okay, we got even more, exceeded expectations in terms of what we were able to get. Well, those were exciting and rewarding in all those ways. But yes, when it gets into the minutia, you know, there's certainly times where, you know, you want to make sure that you're still able to finish the story at the level you started. So there's always that every day kind of living with that all the way to the end. So
is there any particular experience throughout making the film that really stands out to you as something that you come back to and think about quite a bit? Because you traveled the world mm-hmm. filming this, all seven continents, right?
That's right.
So is there anything that sticks out as just that, not necessarily the money shot, because I think you got a lot of money shots in the filming. What does any particular experience stand out to you?
Yeah, there was a few, but the very first one right now that I think of, we were filming in Africa, in Kenya, and we were doing aerials in a helicopter, in a B-3 helicopter. And I'd never been in a B-3. Mm-hmm. It was an A-Star, but it's like the very, very nice A-Star, very powerful. And usually they're B-2s. In the United States and in Alaska and Hawaii, we did aerials in Los Angeles and other places. And they've always been in B2s models. So the B3, and of all places, and I was hoping they were going to have nice, safe helicopters.
Yeah.
But they had three helicopters. All of them were B3s.
Wow.
It was incredible. I mean, I'm like, this is
that's pretty wild.
Pretty wild, right. Yeah. So we were filming air to air over this biplane, this yellow biplane. It's just one shot in the film toward the end of this thing. But we were out in the middle of nowhere filming this thing, and the cloud cover was coming in, and we weren't going to get the shots that we needed, but possibly in an hour or two we could. And we were so far from an airport, we as a helicopter could land pretty much anywhere. And the plane could land not anywhere, but grass strips, and there's dirt and areas all over the place where he was comfortable landing. Mm-hmm. So we took him up on the opportunity to like, okay, let's just put it down here, shut down, and just wait this out, see if we can get the shot. So we did. And after we landed, all these kids, out of nowhere, I don't know where they came from, but like 80, 100 kids and some parents and came out of like nowhere. I have no idea where they came from. It was bizarre. we must have been some village that was close by. I don't know. Anyways, they came over to us. And like, we're all around the airplane and the helicopter and thought it was the coolest damn thing they'd ever seen. And seeing it through their eyes, seeing the wonder, I mean, of this beautiful yellow biplane and this unbelievably beautiful helicopter that I also was just amazed what we're doing and where we are. But to see it through these kids' eyes, of course, we couldn't communicate.
Right.
They were, it's like we were, you know, aliens or something coming down. And it was so inspiring, so emotional. So there was something so human about having somehow creating an experience for them. And I don't know who got more out of it, them or me, to be honest,
yeah.
Because I was so moved by how special this was, how happy they were. And they were some of the happiest people I've ever seen. Mm. And that's a whole nother thing. But there was a moment of just being in Africa was a highlight for me in general.
Mm-hmm.
Kenya specifically just was an amazing, beautiful place. The people are amazing and beautiful. And that experience was one I never could have anticipated, and I can't imagine repeating it.
Mm-hmm.
It was so organic. But I showed them the helicopter, and then when you really see it through their eyes, I mean, this thing is crazy. Helicopter.
Right, right.
It's like, actually, it's crazy. You know, really, it hovers, you know, it goes back, you know, you just take off. You can do anything seeing. I mean, it really is this incredible machine. So that was absolutely, to me, and at case in point with what the film is about, it seeing it through their eyes is the ultimate, having not taken it for granted, mm-hmm. having something brand new. And I wanted in the film to be able to make, in so many ways, aviation brand new to people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard because it's not brand new at all. It's actually often seen as an inconvenience or
right.
frustration or
right.
the feeling that someone gets, the mainstream regular passenger, you know, going commercial flying audience, when they think of going to the airport or flying, or it's a chore. There's a certain association or feeling or anxiety of just the frustration or what they're going to have to go through. They want to still go because they want to go where they're going. But that process, I want to make somehow new again, mm-hmm. and actually not only potentially enjoy that process, but be more tolerant of the process, because the next best alternative to do what we're doing is completely unacceptable. So unacceptable, you probably wouldn't even go where you're going. Because, you know, 15 hours in the car or 2 weeks by boat, 2.5 weeks to get to Australia, plus the train ride.
Right.
It's just, you know, that's an inconvenience.
Mm-hmm.
That's a commitment. That's a month to go spend 3 days there.
And so, there's a line in the movie that I thought was really poignant. It said that if we had to make those sacrifices to go those places, we probably wouldn't go.
That's right.
And it's entirely true. And it's interesting how much of what you just said is in connection to the film, because a lot, again, spoiler alert, everybody, go see the film. It's important to kind of get these connections, but a lot of the narrative was the fact that civilization started in Africa and spread to all the different continents. Well, not all of them, not Antarctica, obviously. But so it's interesting that in the filming of such a movie, you were there and you bridged that, you know, 5,000-year gap that you guys were talking about. So mm-hmm. That's pretty amazing.
It was pretty amazing. Yeah, being there and then the end of the world, Ushuaia, Argentina, which is the southernmost tip of South America, was a very well documented endpoint of the human migration. And so to be in both of those places at all, or in my lifetime, is amazing. To be there in such a short span of time. And then to see that if we really wanted to go between the two nonstop, you really could.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a remarkable concept.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. What was it like filming in Antarctica?
Well, that was cold, first of all.
Yeah.
Very cold, but unforgettable experience. The South Pole, I learned so much in the making of the film, needless to say. I mean,
sure.
So much of what the film ends up saying and showing, or what you might learn from it, a lot of this I didn't know either. It was a discovery process and research process that then becomes a film. Concepts are driving it, and a passion, you know, of mm-hmm. course, is driving it. But Antarctica, so I never realized that the South Pole, that first of all, it's 9,000 feet above sea level. You're on the huge amount of ice.
Right.
And it's ice with a bedrock underneath. There's actually a continent there that's larger than Australia.
Mm-hmm.
But the South Pole is so far away that even when we fly to Antarctica, which we did in a jet, in a Lucian 76 jet, leaving from Chile, actually, flying south, four-hour flight. Once you get there, there were two more flights to get to the South Pole. And all three airports, which are just ice runways, have to line up with VFR weather. And there's no, you know, it's all just, flying by visual clues,
right.
And there's not a lot. It's
right.
white and long, you know, distance horizons, and it's really extreme. It's an extreme place.
Mm-hmm.
Extreme place to fly, extreme place to be. We're in tents for 11 nights. There's no infrastructure.
Wow.
You know, I don't even like camping, so it was extreme.
Hard.
It was extreme. It was negative 40 degrees. Sun never sets because we were there in the summer. The only time
Jeez.
You can fly there. I mean, but an extraordinary experience.
Cool. Very cool. So how much are you involved in the aviation community these days? I mean, obviously if you do nothing else, I mean, you're doing great. I mean, you've mm-hmm. made two amazing films that inspire both aviators in 1/6 Right, and which, by the way, you guys announced that the Blu-ray version is coming out, remastered.
Right.
I'm excited for that. And Living in the Age of Airplanes. So is there anything else you're doing in the aviation community these days to stay connected, or is it just kind of your day-to-day flying?
Well, so right now, you know, certainly there's a reemergence, you know, as this film's now coming out, because I've sort of been secluded for quite some time getting this film made. So it's fun to be out and here at Oshkosh,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, being at aviation events and being around the aviation community again, mm-hmm. and sharing it, of course, with the aviation community, and equally sharing it with the non-aviation community is sort of a way to engage the aviation community,
mm-hmm.
And bridge that gap.
Right.
Yeah, my focus now is really supporting this film, getting this film seen, you know, once you finish a film like this, releasing it, it's like a kid, you know, and just the fact that it's now out there and born, you know, it's important to support it.
Right.
And to, you know, have opportunities like this to talk about it. And so that's my focus now for a little while, at least, you know, more months to really support this thing and, and make sure that its voice is being heard and it can play in as many places as possible. And, so I really enjoy this part of the film because this, the whole point of the film and the years in the making of the film is to get to the point where it's finished and it can start doing and saying what you wanted it to say.
Right.
And it's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. So I love the process of supporting that versus going, getting secluded again, going to tell another story,
right? Exactly,
and dive into just some other thing. It's very fun just to continue to be part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, fan the flames of the conversation, mm-hmm. and share the film.
Yeah, everything in its season. So this is my wife's question that she came up with, and that is, and not necessarily for you, for other people I interview too. And that is, who is your aviation hero? Does anyone stand out?
Wow, aviation hero, man.
Or mentor, or something like that.
Yeah, I can't single out any one person. Mm-hmm. It's probably a collective whole to anyone and everyone that's pushed it forward and that's made it. It isn't any, you know, I'm going to speak very philosophically, I suppose,
sure.
I understand the question. But I think for me, my answer would be kind of like how a movie is hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands of things that come together to make a single experience in the end. Aviation and the state of aviation today and the near perfection of aviation today, technologies that exist, the options we have, the choices that are possible to regular mm-hmm. people for a few $100 to pretty much go anywhere they want is a spectacular moment in time that we live in. And there were people and only people that helped put that together and make that possible.
Right.
And to keep, of course, that going and get people and keep people inspired to keep aviation moving forward and evolving and you know, staying healthy but growing in every way is, to me, where I'm inspired because mm-hmm. it is this thing that is, it started, I mean, it's so cliche, right? It started with a dream and,
sure.
and somebody pursued it and tried and failed and tried again mm-hmm. and failed and then maybe never happened in their lifetime. And then, you know, how many more lifetimes go by? And but the trying and failing and eventually that will to succeed prevailed, and that passion and that belief and continuing to try despite those failures turned into the first, you know, man-powered flight,
right.
which turned into, you know, the rest is history.
Right.
So here we are meeting because of the airplane, no mm-hmm. doubt.
Yeah, and imagine that.
Yeah, and it is, I just think it's an amazing thing, and there's so many people that have made this possible and continue to push it forward, and I just am inspired by the collective whole of the people that have persevered despite the challenges and sacrifices that are made and have been made and continue to be made to push aviation forward.
Right. Yeah, and it's really the responsibility of everybody, lots of people before us and now us sitting here as well. I mean, mm-hmm. you and your films, me and my podcast here. So I know you're a busy guy. I'm going to let you go. But to finish up the show, what would you say to prospective aviators that are looking to get into flying? What would your advice be to them? What would your inspirational message be to them?
First of all, aviation needs you. You know, we need you. We need aviation to grow, and we need pilots. We need it's when you see the film. This is one takeaway I hope that pilots, certainly up and coming pilots, aspiring pilots, will get from the film, is how important aviation is, and how much aviation, therefore airplanes, therefore pilots, and I mean this very literally, how mm-hmm. important a pilot is in the equation.
Right.
Even though it doesn't show it and say it, aviation is contributing to the world unlike any other thing that I know of, in a way and in a level that is it's profound, and it is so important, and so many other things depend on aviation. Aviation is inherently airplanes flown by pilots,
right.
and pilots are there's a responsibility, a privilege, when you realize how important the airplane is in the world and how fascinating. If someone sees the fascination that the movie tries to connect for people, and then it's just one tiny little leap of that it's a pilot behind that, and it's you can be a part of that. You can be what makes that world go around, and you see those shots at the end, and the pilot is the heart of the airplane, right? And the airplane is the heart of the aviation infrastructure that the movie ultimately shows, which is what has made the world be what it is, and the world we enjoy and all love in this time we're living in, and seeing to the depths of the role of the plane in our lives is something that I hope people will really get from the film, and that if you want to be a part of it, you can, and being a pilot is probably the most special and important way to partake in this, you know, miracle of flying in the age of airplanes.
Fantastic. You know, there was one scene at the very beginning of 1/6 Right that made me really emotional. It had a lot of airplanes in it, just flying around. You know, you guys were doing some off-distance work, aerobatics, things like that. And that's the part of that film that made me emotional. The part of this film that made me emotional, I think it's the part that makes pretty much everyone emotional, is at the very end where it talks about, you know, you go through all the destinations in the world, and that home is perhaps the best destination.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's some very beautiful scenes of families from all different cultures, which is absolutely amazing storytelling. It was perfect. Oh, so the fact that, you know, that first film for pilots, that's what that thing did for me, and that's what this one did for me. I think you're on message, and
awesome.
It's very wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure
and,
to be here.
We look forward to what you're going to do next, but we'll have to be patient because you take your time to get this stuff right.
I do.
All right. Thanks,
Thank
Brian.
You. Thank you.
All right, so I hope you guys enjoyed that interview with Brian Terwilliger. Again, we gave away a couple things, but I hope that you come away a little more inspired and with a little more insight into what goes into making a film. And this is just such an amazing film. I was brought to tears at the end. This was done really well, and I was just so impressed. So again, you can go out and request this film. Now, following this, I'm not going to go to silence. If you guys want to stick around for some more audio, some more Q&A that the audience had with Brian, you're welcome to do that. This lasts about 20 more minutes. And the audience there in the theater asked some very, very good questions. The audio isn't as good. You know, I'm not sitting right next to Brian when he is answering those questions. So the audio isn't as good. But I think that if you have headphones on or something, it is still an enjoyable thing to listen to. So thank you so much to Brian for joining us on this little 8-point roll episode of AVeaterCast. I hope you guys are enjoying all these so far. We have more to come. And again, stick around for that audio next of Brian. If you choose on to go to the next one, then that's totally fine too. Either way, I will see you guys soon in the next episode or after you're done listening to the Q&A with Brian Terwilliger. Until then, throttle on. 5-8 is ready. 5-8
is the short line. Turn left heading 235. Maintain 2000. Runway 25 right. Clear for takeoff. Clear for takeoff. 25 right. United 580.
Two questions. How did you find all of the ancient video quality items? And the second one, how did you choose a remote?
Cool. Yeah, two questions. First was about all of that archival footage, the black and white. How do we get that? So it's from 32 films, believe it or not. Nick Spark, who is here at Oshkosh and has a film this week playing, is a filmmaker and just an archival god when it comes to this sort of thing. So I had all of the different, you know, we're looking for this, we're looking for that. Even the wheel lifting off the ground was a shot. I wanted to introduce the plane, not by showing a plane, and not, you know, the Wright brothers aren't in there, Amelia Earhart, Charles Lindbergh, all these things are missing, but it's all intentional. It's a very big picture. You know, 5 minutes, you're going from effectively walking to a jet, you know, engine. And it's not about the details of the milestones. It's not in this film. It's like big pressure. Really, yeah. Just the fact is, we're on the ground for a long time. We're building infrastructure faster, and then all of a sudden, we're not.
Right.
So finding even a shot like that, I'm in the shadows and all these things. And so he's just incredible and found us hundreds of hours of footage, and we would go through that, and then he'd request the film reels, and then we go and transfer it all from film to digital. There are 32 film reels from 32 different sources, and some of them were shipped around the world to us. So that's that. And then as far as the rows, I wanted to show, of course, not just how
We can go places, of course, on airplanes, but things come to us. The world is always on the move, and the physical things part of it. And people who have never flown in an airplane are living in a time where so much of their daily lives or their quality of life is enhanced because of the airplane in terms of the access we have. So Rose was a great example versus an iPhone or any other many items that, of course, fly around that we get shipped to us because it's perishable. It's very common. It's very cross-cultural, and it's very universal of a concept and an idea and the meaning of a flower and a rose. And then it's just so cool that it can go so far so fast. And these flowers really are from all over, everywhere, you know, wherever you live, and the flowers you get in a grocery store. And so telling something that's so familiar to us in a way that we maybe didn't know it or didn't see it, and especially it's in the middle of winter in Alaska 3 days later, I mean, it's just, I don't know any other juxtaposition that could be quite that strong. So that's how that was chosen. Yes?
Okay. As a photographer, do you appreciate the difficulty of photographing somebody wearing a baseball cap under direct overhead?
No, I cannot. It was actually all part of the plan. It's not what I did not want to be photographed.
Are you having a really bad hair day?
No, you tell me.
Okay. Great. Yeah. Did you do that for another minute?
Another minute? Seconds. Oh, but I don't need a... Okay, sure.
Yay!
Yes, there we go. Okay, here we go. Let's get this on.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a first, by the way. That question's a first. That's also the first time I've worn a baseball cap to one of these.
Before,
no, no, no. That's it. But it's a fair question. It's a fair question. Yes.
Yeah, I'm taken by your storytelling technique, and I'm particularly the question about going through all of the footage, the historical footage. Did you have a skeleton framework in mind when you first started writing the story, and then was there a lot of serendipity involved in building that sequence?
Yeah, everything you just said is excellent question, and yes to all of that. Yes, so there was a skeleton, the concept, some even the lines were predetermined, and the basic elements of the story of having perspective, new perspective on something we're so familiar with. How do you do that? How has the airplane changed the world? I had that prompt, and then brainstorm, and there's so many ways to change the world. And as I thought about it more and more and more, and you look online to try to define that question, it's really something you kind of, a lot of it's logical, a lot of the stuff you might know, but it's just told in a way and put together in a way that's different. And that was, there was an endless amount of topics that you could pursue. So choosing which ones was a big part of that process, and things that are going to be very simple to show, and enough things that you get a broad picture of really appreciating what we, I think, so easily take for granted in terms of the airplane's role in our lives. And so that was sketched out. But then going into film it and the experience of making it, new things were happening. I did two quick examples. One is, as I traveled, I always sit in a window seat, always. Recently, there was no window seat, and I ended up changing my flight to a later time when I could have a window seat, or chose a later flight, even though it wasn't as convenient. I'm like obsessed with the window seat. But for the reasons you see in there, and it's more comfortable and all those things. But I really enjoy that view. It is really the special thing. And so that line and sort of the concept, even though the other concepts about ancient civilizations and how they rose and fell and they've never met, and the kind of distance we're traveling is obviously tremendous, and we wouldn't do it any other way, most of us. But realizing what you're seeing out there and the profoundness of what you're seeing in this view is brand new to us, you know, irrespective of what we're doing, where we're going, why we're going there, what's going to happen, and how enriches our life by that experience. The actual journey itself and just that view is an astounding thing. So that sort of hit me in the making of the movie, and all those shots out the window are actually us traveling the world making the movie. And then as far as serendipity in terms of some things I didn't expect, that flower show in Hong Kong, where there were, you know, I don't know, the big monuments of
Making
and the Moai, the head. So believe it or not, we were going to Hong Kong to do some other filming. We were at the Hong Kong airport, and there was some other photography we were doing there. And on the way there, the flower sequence is already done at this point, the Kenya part and the Alaska part, right at the end of filming. And I was flipping through the magazine, whatever airline we were flying. And on one page, they had every destination that they fly, 20 or 30 destinations, a big international carrier. And they had, whatever month this was, I think it was March, they had one event in each of those locations. Just sort of, like, here's a little calendar. Here's one thing happening in Singapore. Here's one thing that's happening in Sydney. Here's one thing. And the one thing, and there's like one sentence with one picture. It was just an interesting collage, right? And in Hong Kong, which is, I'm on the way there on this plane, and it says the Hong Kong Annual Flower Show. And I couldn't believe it. I'm like, this is crazy. Like, what are the chances? And there's a picture. And this year's theme was Monuments of the World. It's like crazy. But I'm like, holy cow, this is insane, right? So we get there, and that became like, you know, practically priority number one. Day one, we went and scouted it. And I'm like, this is crazy, because this is the perfect way to tie together, but also sort of set up that topic. So anyway, that was not planned. And as an independent filmmaker or documentarian, like being open to things and the evolution of it is part of the process, part of the fun, part of the challenge. But I think in the end, things like that happen if you're, you know, watching for them. And if I never flipped through that page, though, I never would have stumbled upon it in Hong Kong. It's not like, you know, it was at the airport or something. So anyway, crazy stuff like that. Yeah, yes.
Early shot in the film of the aerial view of the airport rising up. How did you do that?
That aerial shot in the very beginning is San Francisco International. We're in a helicopter at 12,000 feet, hovering. So
we flew from the best day of the year.
It was a nice day, wasn't it? Yeah, very nice. Yeah, very, very beautiful. And we had permission, which they worked with us. They were amazing.
Were you fixed?
We were, yeah.
Zooming with the camera?
Yeah, just a zoom. Just, okay. Yeah, hovering. So, I don't know if slightly, if there's any helicopter pilots in here. I think we were moving very, very slowly forward, and sometimes we're pivoting on the center point. As a photographer, if you pass that center point, you're looking inverted, and it's a very weird shot because the geometry of it, something's off. So we're not actually vertical. We're looking at maybe 80 degrees, 85 degrees. So we did many, 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 many takes. Only one of them worked, happened to be United Airlines, and, you know, it was good for them. But we didn't choose. It was just whatever shot worked, and whatever shot was the best, and so they got it. It was kind of cool. Yes?
It seemed conspicuous that the people, the pilots, and the people who are in the industry were really left off, and it was really a focus on the machines. Mm-hmm. Almost a love affair with the machine, angles and these glamour shots of the machine. Was that written in at the beginning that's really the focus that you wanted to do? And then the people were the output, the results of the action. That's the focus was.
Yeah, the focus, yeah, was the mantra and sort of the mission of the scope of the film and the story I want to tell is how the airplanes change the world, what the airplane has done. This amazing thing we take for granted, this amazing thing that we see is, I think when people see an airplane, commercial planes, big planes, they already think of an airport, you're going to the airport, there's just a feeling that you have with it that isn't the feeling that we necessarily have with it. I wanted to glorify that machine, certainly, and make us think of an airport, you know, the portal, you're going through those doors, and you realize you're in a building. Depending on which doorway you go down, you're ending up somewhere else in the world. And that's a fact. You know, we're not making this stuff up. Of course it's true. If you think about it like that, it's crazy. When you choose this doorway and you close your eyes, take a seat, wait 5 hours, and you're going to be in Los Angeles. Go down this doorway, take a seat, close your eyes, you could literally be in Paris or in Rome, and it's incredible. So the airport, the airplane, it was important to really have people see that differently, and that was the focus. And the output is how it's enriched our lives, the things it's made possible for us. And so that's really, it's definitely the focus. There was not necessarily an intent to have anything omitted per se, other than I knew it's not pilot oriented, it's not, that wasn't going to be the focus, just by the nature. Yeah, is there another question back here?
Yeah, Brian, what kind of airplane do you fly, your own airplanes?
I fly a SR-71. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Well, to get around to the site pretty quickly.
Yes, that's why I'm wearing a hat so you don't know. I fly 182 Cessna.
Cool.
Yeah, so. Cool. You too. Yes.
I just love that you were nervous to show this to pilots, because I kind of think you should have been. I mean, you know, and I mean that in a very complimentary. I was taken. It was a story of humanity, and I'm kind of like obsessed with the script and the Harrison Ford ringing in my head. I mean, was the script as collaborative as kind of sounds like it was? I mean, did you get anthropologists involved? Was it a whole thing, or was it just a small room and you just came up with scenarios for a long time?
Small room for a long time.
Yeah.
Very much. Yeah. It was, you know, through the writing process, it's just, continuous, you know, it evolves and you refine and evolves and you refine and you throw away. And then you start editing and then you put those words with that and then it doesn't, that doesn't work, or you don't have the shots to support it. And there's certain things you want to show, not tell. That's sort of a mantra too. Show, don't tell, show, especially in a documentary like this. How can we, you know, be more show me, less tell me?
Yeah.
And that over time got better. And we always, I always looked at words per minute, and I would study other films, and just irrespective of topic, but narrated film, March of the Penguins being one of many examples, and literally do a transcription and then count, you know, Microsoft Word, how many words were spoken per minute from the first word to the last word spoken, and see what that per minute average is. And so, like, there's some films, Planet Earth or certain documentaries, have a much higher television, much higher, and then other films much lower, and then there's middle, but it's a huge range. And so, anyways, that was just one driver, just density, you know, of words. And that was something that was really important. Then I look at each section and sequence, and there's a lot of, like, some math and spreadsheets, like, behind it that would somehow influence some things, and, like, you know, that's why that one section. But it was so many processes all happening over a long period of time to finally get it. And we were rewriting in the VO booth and this sort of thing, too.
And what do you think, like, what's your gut instinct about the kind of response you're getting from the geekiest of geeky pilots that wanted to see shiny metal the whole time? You know, are you getting the humanity part of this?
Oh, I think so. Well, there's only been three screenings so far, and I've had the good fortune of making all the excuses ahead of time.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
And very kind, respectful people that are probably not, you know, saying we're all the shiny things, and I don't know. So I don't know, you know, but I think all in all, the point of the film, I mean, the film sets itself up for what it is, and I think, I hope it delivers on what it set out to do. And it is important for me as a filmmaker for the fan base of 163, which is ultimately small, for people that will see this film. Mm-hmm. So the worry should be somewhat contained, and it is. But I do want to have people like the film. I do want to, you know, make a film that resonates for sure. But at the same time, it, like I said at the beginning, you know, the whole concept is going one step further and having aviation be cool and exciting and amazing to people, to a much broader audience than that. And this was just for me how, you know, I found that vehicle. Yes.
You know, I think somebody said before it should be in schools. I think what you did in the pacing, you created a sensual film where we didn't have a chance to absorb visually. The soundtrack's incredible. I stopped to think, like you said, we are dependent. We take so much from that. Even that simple scene of what's in your house, what's on that table, the flowers, the vase, and, you know, covering those countries. It's something that I sound old and I said this, but younger people have no clue, because I think it's just at Target and you can get it. And so I really think that this really gives you such an appreciation, and I think you accomplished what you want to accomplish.
Thank
you. That's
great.
Will definitely cross over demographics all over.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. You know, and the education is an important part of the film. A lot of the science centers and IMAX theaters where they're located is part of their mission. A big part of the mission is schools, school groups, getting kids in, and there's lesson plans, some deep dives that go, that the movie scratches the surface of a whole lot of topics. You know, history of transportation, ancient civilizations, you know, math, speed, time, distance equations. I mean, it touches a lot of things. And so the lesson plans that are driven from it, which already exist in National Geographic, that got attracted to the film, you know, late last fall when it was ready to be distributed, and they're just a natural fit from the educational side, from the obviously the geography side, certainly the quality side. It's an incredible brand to be associated with. They saw the film as a cool, great, fun film that represents so many of their values to be associated with, and then the photography angle and the universal global angle. So the educational is really actually a critical part of the film. So I guess I take a couple more questions and I'll let you guys go. I'm sure there are places to go and things to do. Yes?
When will it be available in CD?
So because it's released the way it is in these theaters and science centers and such, it has to be for 18 months exclusive to theaters. Because they don't book, they do book for 6 to 12 months because it's an exclusive experience. So like Air and Space Museum in DC is playing it now. I think I mentioned that earlier. Played every day, 3 times a day for months and months and months. But they do that because it's, you can only see it there. If it was already on DVD or Blu-ray or on television, then they wouldn't. And so it's important for the film to have the longest, healthiest life it can in those theaters. But inherently then it's limited because it's in 21 cities. I think there's 31 total, and then there's more that will roll out this year and next. So I don't know what cities everyone's from, but if you go to our website, airplanesmovie, airplanesmovie.com, or you can type the whole movie title in, but airplanesmovie.com, and you'll see all the places that it is playing. It's all over the country. It's about to go international. It's in Canada. And then if it's not playing near you, there's a location finder, and you can see what theaters would play it or could play it. And then you can contact them, and it tells you how to encourage those places to take it. So eventually, though, absolutely DVD, Blu-ray, television, iTunes, all of those things will come. But next fall, 2016, unfortunately. Yes.
Okay, so you've done this. So what are you working on next?
Nothing yet. I mean, this is, you know, more or less freshly finished now, doing this traveling and getting the movie to be seen, and it's rolling out in more and more theaters, so I'm going to support that the best I can. But after that, next year, certainly taking some time off and some ideas percolating, but it's going to be a little while before I get into the next one. So at the moment, I'm just collecting ideas and thoughts and letting this thing roll out and be inspired to other stories to tell. But
nothing yet.
No, not necessarily, but I certainly love it. I'm passionate about it. So if I'm passionate about something, I can see it through this many years. And so right now, certainly that's where my passion lies, but we'll see. Yes.
Following on, this gentleman made the comment about pilots approach this as sort of this gearhead kind of way. What I think you did with this movie, which is really excellent, is to remind not just us, but everybody else, of the real wonder of being able to leave the ground here and come down someplace else, different place, different climate and everything.
Right.
So I think you did a fine job. It's well worth doing.
Thank you. So two last questions, and then we'll get these. Yes.
Oh, I had the same question, but I love your filmmaking style. I can't wait for your next project.
Thank you. All right, and then last question.
Can you speak for a moment to music and how you chose the different types of music and James?
Yeah, the music. So yeah, James Horner. I mean, everybody knows James's work. Maybe on Titanic and Avatar and Braveheart, Apollo 13, amazing stuff. And so he's a pilot and. Was very passionate, like Harrison Ford, about it, and I approached him, and he loved what he saw, he loved what it said. That was a really natural fit. But the different styles of music was something that in the editorial creative process, we were doing temp, so we would work with different styles of music and figuring out the tempo for scenes and style for things, and so that there was some groundwork laid that then build upon and evolve, and then eventually had a spotting session where you sit down with the composer and watch the film, talk through every scene and the feeling and kind of what the essence is and the things that need to be hit and all this sort of thing, and then he just does his magic, and you know, so it's such an important part of the film, as you saw, you know, music, visuals, narration, and there you are, you know, there's not characters to follow. Some of the other traditional things that happen in storylines, you know, aren't there. And so it was really a huge, huge component of the film and the email.
Will that be released on CD?
Oh, yeah, the soundtrack will be released. Yes, so.
And I'm sorry about your loss.
No, it's really sad. So, again, thank you all for coming. I can hang out.